Good morning and welcome to the Crawford Stewardship Podcast on WDRT 91.9 FM. I am your host, Joseph Childs, and today, along with Amy Fenn, our Executive Director here at Crawford Stewardship Project, we are sitting down with Ashley Steinke. Ashley is the grassland ecologist for the National Audubon Society in Wisconsin, as well as a grass-fed, grass-finished beef producer in northern Wisconsin. You're listening to WDRT 91.9 FM. You can listen to this online at WDRT.org for this episode as well as many others. So, Ashley, you're the grassland ecologist for the National Audubon Society. So a lot of long words there, and maybe people don't quite know what the Audubon Society is and what they do. So can you give us a little bit of background on that organization?
Yeah, thanks for having me this morning. The National Audubon Society is a hemispheric organization. We work across all country borders, international borders. We have staff throughout North America and South America and around the country. And what we're really in business for is to bend the bird curve. It's no secret that birds across our world are declining in general. And so we're an organization that's been around for over 100 years, and we're really ramping up our work to try to stop that decline of birds and ultimately hopefully turn that curve around and start increasing birds. My job, I'm a grassland ecologist for the National Audubon Society, and I work with farmers and ranchers throughout the state of Wisconsin to increase grassland bird habitat on their property. And one of the reasons that I actually have a job is grassland birds have been found to be our number one declining suite of species of bird species in the country. We've lost over 50% of grassland birds since 1970. So that really brought into focus the work on grasslands and how the National Audubon Society could work on those grasslands. And one of the things we did was introduce the Audubon Conservation Ranching Program. And what that does is it provides a certificate for farmers and ranchers who utilize their grazing techniques to provide better grassland bird habitat on their farms and ranches.
I wasn't aware that the Audubon Society was over 100 years old and like a worldwide organization. It's really impressive that you guys are not just thinking about birds too, but thinking about the farmers and how they can actually help birds come back, and not just pitting farmer against the birds. It's working together and figuring out a way for everybody involved to benefit. So can you talk a little bit more about the decline of grassland birds and maybe some of the causes that have forced that decline of 50% of the species since 1970?
Yeah, so in 2019, Cornell University released a groundbreaking study that showed that we've lost 3 billion birds in North America in the last 50 years. And like I mentioned before, grassland birds top that list of declining species, things like eastern meadowlarks, dick thistles, bobolinks, henslow sparrows, species like that. Our grasslands are very imperiled in this country. Our Great Plains have been decimated. What this really stems from is agricultural policy in our country that has really favored row crop production such as corn and soybeans across the northern tier of this country, and even now expanding down into the southern plain states. We've lost so many of our grasslands, and these birds simply cannot exist without healthy, functioning grasslands. And now most of our grasslands in this country are privately owned by farmers and ranchers. And what we think and what we're finding is good management of pastures, good management of these farms and ranches is also good management for bird production and for the success of these grassland birds. And so the certification that I talked about, the Audubon Conservation Ranching bird-friendly certification, it really takes a set of protocols into play where we address things like specific grazing practices, but we also address things like humane handling of animals, environmental integrity on farms and ranches. So we're not just looking at the grassland bird habitat. We're looking at everything on the farm, right? We're looking at riparian area protection, protection, wetland restoration, proper grazing of oak savannas for birds that typically aren't found in grasslands, but things like red-headed woodpeckers that are found on the edges of grasslands where they transition into oak savanna type habitat, specifically in your guys' country in that driftless area of Wisconsin. So the program really focuses on a holistic method on the whole farm and ranch and not just the grassland component of it.
That's encouraging to hear. Someone that works for an organization that is dedicated to birds, speaking quite a bit about farming and maybe not so much farming, but land management. And, it just so happens that coming from an agricultural state like Wisconsin and a lot of the states in the Midwest and upper Midwest that are, the dominant land management practice is farming. So when you're talking about managing land for ecosystem services, such as providing habitat for wildlife, beneficial wildlife, you're going to have to talk to the farmers and have to work together with them. So it's encouraging hearing that an organization as storied and as large as the Audubon Society is thinking about the farmers and, wanting to work with them instead of against them. So I wanted to talk a little bit, since we're talking about farming and birds, and this question I mean to ask in a way of, why should farmers care about birds? What are the things that the birds either indicate or provide to a farmer that would make it beneficial for a farmer to, at the very least, notice birds and maybe pay attention to them?
Sure. Let's talk about history a little bit. So if we look back before you and I and Amy were born in the 1960s, crouching in on 1970, we had a chemical called DDT that we were using on our landscape, right? And this chemical was causing eggshells of birds like eagles and ospreys to be really soft, and they were breaking and they were not viable in a nest. And those bird species were on the brink of extinction at that time, and our country recognized that. And at the time, we recognized that we needed to do something about that, that we really couldn't let these birds be extirpated and face extinction in this country. And so we banned the use of that chemical, right? Because we saw it as a good thing for society to have these birds around. And I think that that's just an example, really, of before we get into the farming side of things, just as a society and as an agricultural industry, like, do we want to be the ones that oversaw this land management that made these birds decline so bad, right? And there's a lot of things happening with loss of our grasslands that's causing these grassland birds to be in decline. And one of the misnomers is that we can't have farming and can't have birds. But that couldn't be farther from the truth. So I think we really, as a country and as an agricultural industry, really need to take a hard look at ourselves and figure out, like, what can we do as stewards of the land? Because farmers are the best stewards of the land that we have in this country. Farmers and ranchers are. And what can we do to bend this bird curve? Because it's just, things like birds, they need healthy insect populations, healthy soils, healthy plants, and it's kind of all the things that farmers need, right? We need healthy insects for pollination, need healthy soils to grow the crop. We need healthy air to breathe when we're out there, so that the birds and the farmers really go hand in hand. And it doesn't have to be one or the other. Whether you're a corn and soybean grower or you're a rancher, all of us can do some things on our farms and ranches that can really bend that bird curve and make a difference on it. As a matter of fact, when we had the most grassland birds in this country, and I think of, I'll use a species like prairie chickens as an example. We used to have prairie chickens in the southern third of Wisconsin when Europeans first arrived here, and then the great cutover happened where we cut most of our forest down, and then we had that small-scale farming, right? Think about great-grandma and grandpa who milked 10 cows, and they had a 3-acre oats field and a 5-acre corn field, and there were weeds on the margins. That's when we had the most birds, and prairie chickens expanded to every county in Wisconsin. And so, back then we didn't have good grazing practices, right? We weren't rotational grazing with poly reels and all this technology that we have now. We're literally kicking the cows out in the back pasture for 12 hours in sort of a dry lot. They were eating what they could, and then they got fed in the barn. So really, like, at that time, farming was compatible with birds. And as we've got, as we've had more technology creep in with things like with more chemical usage, seed treatments, things like that, we've made it a pretty hard landscape for birds to live in.
So what I'm gathering as far as you know, the downfall or, you know, the losing of species over the past, you know, 50 years, it wasn't because, you know, people, they didn't go the way of the bison where people are going out hunting them into extinction. It's more they're just losing their habitat, and that's as a byproduct of that, they're losing their lives. So it's not something where we can just stop hunting them, or, you know, we have to build back that habitat that has been lost in order to really bring back these birds. And, you know, they're an indicator species not only for how healthy your farm is, but the way you put it, it's almost an indicator species for how healthy the farming economy is and how healthy the farming community is. Because without all these birds, it's generally a not great environment for small family farms either.
Absolutely, Joe. You know, when I think back, you know, you mentioned that we don't have to stop hunting these things. And, you know, the grassland birds that we could potentially hunt in Wisconsin are things like the prairie grouse with prairie chickens and sharp-tailed grouse. But all the rest of the birds, like, I grew up a hunter, and I started going hunting with my dad when I was really young, and that's what really got me started in this in the conservation career. I spent a lot of days as a kid going down to the little creek in our small town and watching wood ducks in the spring when they first came back. And then we had an ecology teacher in high school that took us on birding trips. And one of the things I remember was being able to stand in my high school parking lot and listen to eastern meadowlarks sing in fields behind our school. And those fields were hay fields at the time that were probably cut late, and that's what, and it was kind of a wide open landscape. That's why we had those birds there. And now all those fields have turned to corn and soybeans, and the eastern meadowlarks are gone.
So I want to talk because I think it's such a powerful statement that I actually wrote it down because I really didn't want to forget it. And you said you got started in conservation as a hunter. I think there's a good portion of the population, maybe not so much our rural community out here, but there's a good portion of the population that statement would make absolutely zero sense to them, because they think as a hunter, you know, you're killing wildlife, so how can you be involved in conservation? But as any hunter knows, and as any person who lives out in a hunting community, the hunters are generally the people that care the most about the wildlife and care the most about the habitat in which it lives. Because that is how they either, you know, maybe it's just sport and they're going out because they, you know, they eat the animal, but they really do it because it's a bonding experience. It's a tradition that they're carrying on. But there are some people still that they're relying on that meat each year. You know, they don't raise their own meat, or they, you know, they can't afford to buy meat at the grocery store in bulk. So they're relying on that. So if the habitat isn't conducive for producing a plentiful amount of game, then that's affecting their lives too. So I just wanted to dive in a little bit deeper on that statement to drive home the fact that that is a sentiment that a lot of people here in rural Wisconsin and in rural America and in hunting communities feel very, very close to the idea of conservation as a hunter. So sorry to interrupt, I just wanted to dive into that a little bit.
Yeah, and furthermore, hunters need to do a better job of telling our story and telling about how hunters have been the catalyst for conservation in the modern conservation movement, right? We recognize at the early part of the 20th century that we had decimated game populations through unregulated market hunting, and hunters were the first ones that ponied up the idea of conservation and things like bag limits and season structures and things like that. And to go even further, people need to understand that hunters are the ones that really foot the bill for conservation. All license and tag sales go to state game agencies, state fish and wildlife agencies. There's things like the Pittman-Robertson Act, which has gun and which takes gun and ammunition sales, and that money gets a certain portion of that money through an excise tax is distributed to states and to fish and wildlife agencies and land grant universities for things like habitat management and research. And I'm actually a direct benefit of the Pittman-Robertson Act. When I did my master's work in South Dakota studying Merriam's wild turkeys in the Black Hills, most of my project was funded through the Pittman-Robertson Act. And then we could dive even further into, you know, in any small town in these rural hunting communities that you talk about, at least once or twice a year, you can find fundraising banquets that are attended by people who hunt and fish and are there to give their money and try to win things. But ultimately, that money goes back into the conservation pot. So I think that's a really important point. I really appreciate you bringing that up.
Yeah, you brought it up. I just wrote it down and brought it back up again. But yeah, I had to chuckle a little bit when you talked about the fundraisers, because I've been a part of many, you know, a rabbit hunter, a catfishing tournament, stuff like that. And it usually is, you know, for a benefit of someone in the community that needs some help. And, you know, some people are there to win raffles and stuff like that, and other people there to have a good time. But they're both spending money and helping out the community. We are going to pause here quickly for a little station identification. You're listening to the Crawford Stewardship Podcast on WDRT 91.9 FM. You can find this episode as well as many other archival episodes of radio shows and podcasts on WDRT.org. I'm your host, Joseph Childs, and today I'm sitting down with my executive director at Crawford Stewardship Project, Amy Fenn, as well as Ashley Steinke. Ashley is the grassland ecologist for the National Audubon Society in Wisconsin, and he's also a grass-fed, grass-finished beef producer in northern Wisconsin. And today we're sitting down with Ashley talking about birds and farming and hunting and all sorts of different things. Ashley and I have some overlapping interests in the grazing world, and then there's lots of stuff I can learn from him as far as talking about birds. I've always been interested in them, but as you can tell, Ashley is very, very well versed in his bird knowledge. So I wanted to ask you maybe a question you get quite a bit, Ashley, but I'm interested in. So what is your favorite grassland bird, if you had to pick one?
That's an easy question. My favorite grassland bird is the greater prairie chicken.
I don't think I've ever seen one, maybe in a book.
Yeah, the greater prairie chicken actually in Wisconsin is imperiled right now. We only have them in two counties in central Wisconsin, Wood and Portage County. And I'm actually, the Audubon Society, we've created a larger project in those counties working on private lands for habitat work. For those chickens right now, we're working on removing some barriers to habitat, things like tree rows and brush encroachment, and it's just really fun. They're kind of a keystone species for our grassland. I'm actually leaving this afternoon to go watch prairie chickens dance on their lecking grounds, which is basically where the males come together and they all dance in an area, and then females attend that lek. And the females are bred there and on the lek, and then the females go off in the nearest grasslands to nest. And it's this really great booming sound that you can hear from like a mile away. And it's really kind of a rite of spring in central Wisconsin. And I'd encourage anybody, there are blinds that you can rent set up on state-owned properties. And I encourage anybody who hasn't seen them to get up there and watch those things. It can really be a life-changing experience.
That sounds, well, I've never done it, so I don't know if it's fun or not, but it sounds interesting. I've never heard someone say, I'm actually leaving tomorrow to go watch chickens dance. So, sorry if you heard me chuckle. I couldn't quite keep it together on that one, but, I believe I've seen some documentaries or something about about prairie chickens, but I don't think I've ever heard that sentence in my life. So that was an interesting one.
If you stick around me long enough, and we start working together more, Joe. You'll have more times where you'll chuckle on things than I'll say.
Yeah, you're going to a barn dance for prairie chickens. I like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And then this weekend on Saturday is actually the annual Prairie Chicken Festival. In Wood County at the Aaron Event Barn, and we host birding tours. People will be in blinds watching chickens, and they come back and several of us are presenting to the crowd. There's a breakfast that happens in this event barn, and it's really a whole day to celebrate prairie chickens. And it's the folks that are involved in this, we're all very passionate. It's kind of funny this time of year because our phones are ringing nonstop with all of us who survey these things. Like, what did you see this morning? How many were on that lek? And how many were on this lek? Was there any females? And so it's kind of a rite of passage every spring for us that, you know, we get the ball rolling in the grassland bird season and our survey season.
I will have to write that down and get up there one of these times when the chickens are dancing. So I wanted to maybe take that into the next question here. So you talked about the Prairie Chicken Days or Prairie Chicken Festival. Is that attended by, you know, mostly people that are kind of in the know or in the grassland bird community, or is that, do you get newbies there that are looking to learn or just heard about it? And I guess, well, I'll let you answer that, and then I've got a follow-up for that.
Yeah, I mean, we get people actually from all over the country that come to Wisconsin to watch prairie chickens dance. There's people that will fly in from New Jersey to come watch these things. So it's anybody from land conservation staff to bird conservation folks, but also people that are just really interested in the survival of that species and the survival of our healthy grasslands in Wisconsin that want to come and show support for these ecosystems and for these birds. We have a lot of momentum right now. There's a lot of interest currently in saving these things and saving these grasslands, and so I'm really looking forward to Saturday. And we have, like I said, this momentum we have with ourselves and partners really ramping up habitat work in that part of the state, working across public and private land boundaries. And so I have a lot of hope going into the future that we can really help this species out and help. And one nice thing is when you're sitting in a prairie chicken blind, usually you're surrounded by eastern meadowlarks and other grassland bird species, too, that are back from their winter migrations. And so it's kind of like a spiritual experience to be out there listening to all these birds in the morning, you know, in the spring and their mating rituals.
Yeah, it sounds incredibly interesting. So I wanted to follow up with that one. So having new people coming in, what is one of the first things that you want to teach the new people that are coming in? Say someone, you know, just has a passing interest in grassland birds or just birds in general. So what's the first thing that you find that the public is really yearning to learn, or maybe they need to learn? Maybe there's a misconception that you have to kind of put to bed.
Yeah, well, I think the first thing is just like how life-changing it is to most people. So 2 weeks ago, I took a girl out scouting prairie chicken leks, got to the first one in the dark, pulled up, got out, and we're standing there, and pretty soon four prairie chicken males flew in and started dancing and booming. And all that I could hear her saying next to me was, wow. Like, she was just amazed at this. And she had seen other grouse species in other parts of the country do their thing in the spring, but prairie chickens were just different to her. So it's really just like, the first thing is just, these things actually exist, and they exist here in Wisconsin. that's probably the biggest misconception we always get is, like, because prairie chickens, the greatest populations we have are in the Great Plains states of Nebraska, Kansas, South Dakota, eastern Colorado, but people don't realize that they're east of the Mississippi River too. And we actually used to have them throughout all of the states, all the way out into the East Coast. I mean, we used to have prairie chickens on Martha's Vineyard, and now we've contracted this far, right? And then the other misconception we hear a lot is just that they can survive in a highly fragmented landscape, and people don't think they can. But if we provide just that right habitat with healthy grasslands in a fragmented landscape, because let's face it, like when you drive across our countryside, we're pretty fragmented now with roads and power lines and farmhouses and other development pressures going on, you know, a lot of energy production that's starting to happen. But these birds, if we provide the right habitat in the right places, that we can hold on to these species. And I think that's probably the biggest misconception, is that they can even survive in this landscape. But if we provide that healthy habitat through land protection, but most importantly through just really good stewardship of our private farms and ranches, that comes with that good grazing management that we have.
So, yeah, I'd like to talk a little bit about grazing and the connection with it as well, too. And, you know, you talked about the conservation ranching program. So what are some things that that grazing offers, maybe that the cutting hay doesn't, or that, you know, having a row crop doesn't, or that, you know, just other farm practices doesn't offer that can be beneficial to grassland birds, and maybe some things that grazing, and, you know, maybe in a not proper way can be detrimental to grassland birds.
Sure. So proper rotational grazing, that word diversity that we always talk about, right? That word diversity we talk about in wildlife biology, that our ecosystems are healthiest when we have a diverse array of plant species and wildlife species. When we're grazing on farms, and as you know as a grazer yourself, the amount of diversity that you'll have in your pastures through wildflowers, annual weeds. Annual weeds are very important for birds. They provide this really high-energy seed late in the summer during migration periods, a time when they need that high energy to start putting on fat for winter. But we provide that diversity of habitats through grazing. And there's this word that we use in the bird world all the time, heterogeneous landscape. And what that means is that we provide different levels of structure throughout our grasslands by proper rotational grazing, right? So you put your cattle into a paddock and we graze it till it's 4 inches tall or 6 inches tall or 8 inches tall, whatever it is, depending on each farmer's preferred method of management. But the paddock right next to it is 18 inches tall. And if we have proper rest rotation where we're resting those farms and resting those pastures for anywhere from 40 to 60 days after a grazing event, that's enough time for a bobolink to get in there, lay her nest, lay her five eggs, incubate, hatch out those eggs, and fledge those young out of that pasture before cattle come back there, right? And then the beautiful thing about cattle is they leave behind the manure, and in properly managed pastures, that's providing a ton of insect life. And those chicks of bobolinks, for that first part of their life, rely 100% on protein, which comes in the form of bugs and insects in that pasture. And that's just those, you know, haying can be very bird-friendly, but it's providing that structure they need. But if we don't have that grazing component on a lot of farms, we're losing out on that insect production that's so important for those first weeks of those birds' lives.
I guess I never even thought of, you know, when I think of manure as a resource, I'm thinking of it for the soil and for the plants, but I never really put two and two together that the bugs that come along with it are actually sustaining an entire different part of the ecosystem. So that's a really good, you know, point to prove or point to use when you're talking about grazing versus haying when it comes to grassland bird management. And so I wanted to talk maybe a little bit. You talked about the different sort of structures here.
I just want to interrupt you real quick.
Yeah, go ahead.
You know, what's really fun is when you're doing a grassland bird survey in June, I'll use my farmer example. Last year, myself and my supervisor, Tom Presby, who's the conservation manager for Audubon Great Lakes in Wisconsin, we were surveying our farm, and we had, I think, four male bobolinks singing around us. And then we started picking up, I think it was two or three female bobolinks that were right around us, and they were flying. You could tell they were flying out of a nest, and when they were coming back, they would land on pigtail posts that were separating my paddocks, and you could tell they had live young in a nest because they were actually carrying insects in their bills. When you looked at them, like, you know, they would land 20 feet away on a pigtail post, and you look at them in binoculars, and their bills were full of insects that they were carrying back to their nest to feed their young in our pastures.
I think that's a great story to end on. It's a good feel-good story. So for the radio listeners, we are going to wrap up here, but don't worry, you can find us online at wdrt.org. This has been Joseph Childs, and I've sat down here with Amy Fenn and Ashley Steinke for the Crawford Stewardship Podcast, brought to you by Crawford Stewardship Project here on WDRT 91.9 FM. Ashley, I appreciate you stopping by for the radio show, and stick around. And those who want to listen to the rest of this interview, you can go to wdrt.org and find the Crawford Stewardship Podcast. So, Ashley, you talked a little bit about the different structures that grazing can offer. You know, you've got a pasture that is yet to be grazed. It may be 12 to 14 inches tall, and then you've got a pasture that you just moved out of and just grazed that is, you know, 4 to 8 inches tall. And you spoke about the importance of having those different structures. So when it comes to, say, native grass prairies or native plant prairies that seem to be kind of all the rage now, you know, everyone wants to have native plants on their property, which is great. But oftentimes these are kind of a preservation versus conservation. They're planted and then they're left alone. Don't touch them, don't mow them. You burn them every once in a while, but other than that, they're kind of like put under glass and left there. So you know, they look pretty. They've got a bunch of different flowers and stuff in it. But is that a bird friendly way to go about things? Is that a good management style? What would be the pros and the cons of doing something like that? Is coming from a bird habitat viewpoint?
Yeah, I think we really have to look back 150 years to answer that question. Our native prairies, what happened on them? We had large ungulates, large animals that were grazing those prairies, right? We had huge herds of bison. We had huge herds of elk. We had all these grazers on the landscape. And what we're really finding, Joe, is these native warm season prairies, they become so dominated with the big three grasses of big bluestem, Indian grass, and switchgrass. And from a bobolink and meadowlark perspective, is when those grasses mature into their what they're going to be after 3 to 5 years after post-planting, is they become really too tall and too thick for those birds to use. Now, there are other grassland bird species like a Henslow sparrow that if you're in the right area that you might have some of those nesting in that, because Henslow sparrows need a lot of residual to nest, and they're a hard bird to manage for on grazing farms because we don't provide as much residual. But in a majority of places that I see these native warm seasons, we don't have Henslow sparrows, and then it really becomes sort of a bird desert, if you will, because it's just too tall, it's too rank, there's too much residual, birds can't move through them. When the chicks are young, they have a hard time walking through them. So really what we're talking about is trying to bring grazing back into those ecosystems and those native grass pastures and native prairie pastures. And what that does is just helps provide that structure. You know, when those cattle are moving through there, they're grazing, they're trampling some, they're leaving others, and it just doesn't get as tall, and it just has that whole sort of recycling effect of those grasslands, right, that cattle can provide. And another beautiful thing about native prairie stuff is in Wisconsin, as a grazer myself, I'm guilty of this, but 100% of grazers, every grazing farm I'm on, Amy, what do we complain about in July? We complain about the summer slump, right? We're all sitting mm-hmm. there and our grass isn't growing because we're all grazing improved non-native cool season grasses, and it's hot out and they're not growing and our cattle aren't putting on weight, and we're all calling each other and we're like, oh man, this is like the worst time of the grazing season is July 15th. Cattle aren't gaining weight. Grasses are standstill. There's no rain in sight. And then you go look at a native prairie planting and that stuff is going gangbusters. It's 3.5 feet tall. It's lush green. And I think the research shows on the palatability of it, if you graze it at the right time, just like cool season grasses, right? If it gets to head out and it gets old and it gets mature, whether it's a cool season or a warm season grass, it's not as palatable. But when you hit that, when it's in this leafy stage, just like cool seasons, the quality is really high, and the research on cattle gain shows that cattle gain really well on it. So I'm really trying to promote more farms having a warm season component where you can graze May and June on your cool seasons, and then you get off your cool seasons and graze warm seasons for the month of July and August, then get off those and get back on your cool seasons in September and through October and November to finish up the grazing season. And what that does is it provides you a ton of forage in the middle of the summer, but it's also resting those cool season grasses for potentially 60, 90, 100 days to really improve that plant structure to finish out that grazing season. And the beautiful thing is if we graze that for birds for those warm seasons, we graze that, we provide that structure in those warm seasons, then the next year we're not grazing it till the middle of July, and the birds have nested and got out of there already, so it's really bird friendly.
Yeah, it seems like that's, it's almost, you know, I hate to say the killing two birds with one stone thing, but you really are you're feeding two animals with one grassland, or housing two animals with one grassland. It seems like if the stuff that is tall and maybe gets rank, that's not, you know, great for birds, and it's not really great for cows either. So grazing that at the right time would, you know, both thin it out for birds, provide that manure resource for insects that provides insects for the birds, and you're also obviously feeding your cattle a more palatable grass, and also stretching the cool season grasses and giving, you know, whatever animals are living in your cool season grasses or that are thriving in those, you're giving them time to, you know, their habitat is growing back in those summer months where, like you said, it can be rough when you go from May 15th and your grasses are going crazy and you think, well, I'm never going to run out of grass. And then a month and a half later, you're sitting there thinking, where did all the grass go?
You know, having every summer, something, doesn't it?
Yeah, every summer, and having something that could act as maybe a buffer to level out those highs and lows of the cool season grasses, and then also just be a resource for other wildlife, be it turkeys, deer, birds, whatever else is growing in, or is grazing or living in that native prairie planting. It seems like both sides of the spectrum could benefit. The people that are completely, I just want to have birds here, and I don't really care about raising cattle. And then the farmers that are saying, I just want to put weight on my cattle, and I don't care if the birds are here. It seems like both of them could come together and have the same conclusion of, yeah, maybe we should just run cows through some of these native prairie plantings and improve the habitat for both species. So that's a very rare, sounds like it's a very rare win-win-win situation there.
And the interesting thing of traveling around the state like I do, working with farmers from the Driftless area of Wisconsin to almost Milwaukee to Green Bay to every corner of the state, is most of us as grazers are doing a really great job with grassland bird habitat. And it's not that much of a stretch to just tweak some minor things on most farms to make it even better on these places, whether it's things like woody removal. So one of the biggest things that's affecting grassland birds in this country is woody encroachment. And in Wisconsin, that's in the form of when you drive across the landscape and you see all these long tree rows going through our grasslands where there used to be a barbed wire fence, right? The farming that I talked about before of our great-grandfathers, when they put barbed wire fences around every 40 and 80 acres, and then we stopped burning and grazing and mowing under those fences, and now it's all like ash trees that are dying and elm trees that are dying and box elder trees, kind of junky stuff. That's one of the biggest issues our grassland birds are facing, is that kind of woody encroachment in Wisconsin. So that's one of the biggest things I see on almost every farm, has that sort of component that we could work on. But otherwise, like grazers in general, whether they're doing it, like you said, for the birds, or whether they're doing it strictly for pounds per animal throughout the grazing season, it's not that much of a stretch to get to really good bird habitat on these farms.
So this is you set me up perfectly here, Ashley, to talk about what I think is one of the most important questions for both bird people and farmers to hear. And to get the answer to it. So is there a trade-off between conservation for birds and grazing as a business? Can they both operate at near or maybe even possibly 100% efficiency on the same farm? Or is there a slight trade-off to where you have to value the birds being there in order for it to be, you know, a value to you? Or I guess, am I putting that question in a way that you understand it?
Exactly. So Audubon Conservation Ranching Program, so far we've signed up over 115 farms and ranches totaling about 3 million acres in North America. And so really the proof is kind of in the pudding. These are working ranches that we signed up. Of course, it kind of takes a bird conservation ethic to want to be Audubon certified and really care about the birds, because it's, you know, sometimes there's a change in management a little bit, like, you know, like we want to rest certain pastures. Like if I come to your farm, Joe, and we look at your farm, and, you know, there's part of it that's the best grassland bird habitat on your farm. We want to try to rest those acres during the nesting season. But the way we're getting around that is, and I'm doing this on my farm, is I've identified through bird surveys where we have, excuse me, the highest densities of nesting grassland birds. I'm resting those. I'm grazing all around it during the nesting season, approximately May 1st to July 15th. And then once that nesting season is over, where I'm starting to see way less birds in the pastures, bobolinks at that time are starting to head to their wintering grounds in Venezuela and Argentina. They leave as early as the mid-July to start that migration. So when you start seeing a lot less birds, then I bring a class of cattle into those pastures that have been rested all year, like bred heifers or cows that don't need as high of nutrition, that we're not really trying to put 2 pounds of beef on per day like we are on stockers. And I'll go in there and I'll mob graze that on July 15th or August 1st. And then I get those cattle off there and then I rest it for 60 days. And what does that give me? It gives me really lush stockpiled growth of grass come October 1st that I can then put those cattle back on, or even put my stockers on that I'm looking to finish that following spring and really start putting on weight for October and November before we start going on to stored feed. So it's things like that that we might have to tweak management a little bit. So it does take, you know, having a little bit of an open mind to say, well, you know, some older people might say, well, I've been grazing this way for 35 years and it's worked and we're profitable. And what we always say too is we work right alongside with these farmers and ranchers, right? We're not coming in to like change everything up, because we need you on the landscape. We need farmers and ranchers in this country. We need them to raise high quality food for us. But we also just need them for bird habitat. So it's a give and take. But it's not, like I said before, it's not that hard to get there.
Yeah, it seems the way you talk about it, it seems like it's not changing it in a way that saying you have to be less efficient or you have to be, you know, set aside this and you're losing a resource. It's maybe rearranging the order in which you use the resource. So how you talked about on your farm, there's a spot where you know that there's, through surveys, you know, through doing your research on your farm, you've identified areas that the birds really like, and maybe you were grazing them as part of the early rotation, and instead of doing that, you maybe, instead of going clockwise, you go counterclockwise around your farm, and you get to that pasture later in the summer when the birds are fledged out and, you know, they've left the nest and they're not in danger anymore. So it's not like you're telling farmers that, you know, this 10 acres you have to set aside and you can't use it anymore. It's saying, like, well, maybe instead of grazing that in May 15th, May 18th, graze it August 1st, and you just go on a different route around your farm. And that's something that I agree with you. It can be hard to convince maybe people that are set in their ways, but, you know, maybe those aren't the people that you're targeting. There's always going to be that class of people that just, this is how I'm doing it and I'm not changing. But I think if, you know, given the chance to sit down and speak with someone like you, who is so obviously passionate about what he does, passionate about the birds, passionate about farming, you know, sitting down with you for 10, 15 minutes, walking through the pastures, I think that people would be hard-pressed to not at least give it a shot, because you speak very eloquently about it. You obviously know your stuff. You're passionate. I can hear the excitement in your voice. So the Audubon Society is great. He's very lucky to have someone that's like you working for him and that talks about farming in a way that you do, almost as excited as when you talk about birds.
Well, I appreciate the kind words. And it's really, I started this job in July of 2023, and it was kind of funny. I was a stay-at-home dad running our farm, but my background is in wildlife management. And so, like, everything we do on our farm, we've restored 16 wetlands so far. We've turned it, when we bought the farm in 2014, it was all corn and soybeans. We've turned it all back to grass. Then this job announcement came open for Audubon that was like, the description was working with farmers throughout Wisconsin to increase grassland bird habitat while maintaining profitable farms. And I was like, well, this was written for me. So I just applied for it, and here I am. But the reception we've had in Wisconsin so far has been just tremendous. The first year we had 35 individual farms express interest, totaling about 6,000 acres, and we're getting to most of those farms. Where, you know, as you can imagine, traveling throughout the whole state, we don't get them all done in a day. So we're working on the habitat management plans on several farms and still conducting more site visits. But since then, in the last almost a year now, so it'll be 2 years in July, but in the last year, I've had about another 30 farms sign up that are interested. So we're looking at about 60 farms and probably, you know, over 10,000 acres so far in Wisconsin that are interested in this program. So the reception and has been great in Wisconsin, and being able to do things like this podcast. This last Friday, I was able to present to the Wisconsin Science Teachers Society, High School Science Teachers Society in southeastern Wisconsin. There was science teachers throughout the whole state that are going to take this information back to their classrooms and create programs with it. So it's really fun, and it's a really fun job working with people. And then, heck, I mean, today I get to take an hour off and work calves on my own farm this morning before I go do prairie chicken stuff. So, I kind of live the lifestyle both ways.
You might be the first farmer that I've heard that is excited to go work cattle.
It's actually kind of my zen, right, to be out with my cattle and moving them in the summer. But even like today, working them through a chute and stuff, I kind of enjoy that. So.
I enjoy it on operations that have a good setup. That it seems like the setup is everything. If it can either be the worst part and you learn a bunch of new words that you didn't know you knew, and or it can be super nice where it's, you know, just running through, you got an alley and everything.
What's the big joke? If you and your wife are having an argument, just go work cattle together and you'll get you'll get everything out in the open right then and there.
Yeah, I think that was one of the first times I ever truly like talked back to my old man was working cattle.
What's your go-to handling system, Joe?
Well, I had bought a bunch of portable panels secondhand, just, you know, use what I could afford, and yep. Then built some, you know, wooden alleys. But the nature of my business is very portable, so yep. A lot of the times it's setting up portable chutes, feeding them in that chute for a while, or portable corrals, and then feeding them in there for a while, and then locking them in there one day, and then just bring a bunch of help.
Yeah, you know, you talk about portable corral panels. That's strictly what I've went to on my farms. My wife and I are lucky enough that we have two different farms that we farm on up here in Chippewa County. And if I can give any advice to any aspiring farmers or even people that are, you know, farming already and thinking about how to set up a better handling facility for working cattle, these 24-foot portable freestanding corral panels are like the best thing ever invented for cattle operations in Wisconsin. You know, they can be moved around with a tractor with forks or a skid loader, and if something doesn't work, you can move them around and tweak it until it does. And on our place, we've set up three different bud boxes. And since we did that, and our life has just changed in terms of working cattle, it's just so calm, it's quiet, animals stay quieter, just way less stress. And I think that's probably one of the reasons why I enjoy it, is because of the way we've set some things up. And that was literally years of going to pasture walks and Grassworks conferences and listening to people that know way more than I do about farming talk about handling cattle. And it's just made life way easier.
Yeah, it's amazing what you can learn from people that have been there and done that. And I think that's honestly one of the best ways to learn, is someone, maybe they don't have the title or the certification or the degree that says that they should know everything, but if they've been doing it and they've been through it, they've stepped in the pitfalls, they've had the successes, those are generally the people that I'd enjoy listening to and learning from the most.
Absolutely.
I wanted to talk just maybe a little bit more about farming and birds, or more so grazing and birds. We talked a little bit earlier about different forages and different structures on the farm, different grass length. But are there differences in forage requirements between grazing and managing? Or like, are you going to have to plant a different seed mix, or can you graze what you can use for bird habitat?
Yeah, what I always talk about is grassland birds really don't seem to care what kind of grass is out there. I mean, heck, in central Wisconsin where we have prairie chickens, when I was doing my research on prairie chickens, we were finding a lot of prairie chicken nests. Most of them were in quack grass. A lot of them were in reed canary grass, and it's really what they had available to them and what that available structure was. You know, things like the pretty common pasture grasses in Wisconsin are things like meadow fescue and timothy and orchard grass and things like that. And fescues are, can be really bad for birds if they're left to their own devices. And when I say that, I mean not grazed and not provided that structure, but cattle grazing provides that structure that is needed with clump grasses and for chicks to move around. So we don't really have to change much on farms in Wisconsin, and other than I would like to see that more of a warm season component. But what we have typically works as long as we're doing good grazing management. And the only other thing I'll say about that and forage requirements is a thing I often see in Wisconsin, and it's a term I used a little bit ago, is mob grazing, right? Mob grazing is great for grazing operations in terms of soil health, forage utilization of cattle, but mob grazing was really a benefit to dairy cattle initially, right? When we're May and June and we get them in there and we eat it down and we keep that vegetative state of that plant. And a lot of what I'm seeing when I travel on farms is we're still mob grazing, which is great, but we're doing it for birds at the wrong time of year. So we can't really be going into our best grassland bird habitat and mob grazing in June, because what we're doing is trampling all the bird nests. So when I talked about mob grazing on my farm, I'm waiting to do it until after the nesting season and then reset that vegetation and get it back in a vegetative state. So it's kind of getting away from that dairy mentality, because so many of these dairy farms are now beef farms, as we all know in Wisconsin. So we get away from that mentality of having to mob graze, or if we are going to mob graze, let's mob graze the portions of the farm that are not grassland bird habitat, which almost every farm in Wisconsin has areas of the farm that are not grassland bird habitat. Let's do it there and rest those areas where the best nesting habitat is.
Yeah, I think that kind of comes back to what you talked about earlier with it doesn't have to be a less efficient grazing operation just because you're managing, tweaking your management to maybe allow more grassland birds to be on the farm. You know, you can still mob graze, but maybe mob graze is stuff that's, you know, closer to the buildings, the stuff that, you know, maybe the birds aren't, you know, aren't quite as apt to come and nest in. And then, yep, you know, leave those back portions, those fringe habitats back by the woods and maybe further away from the homestead. You know, that's probably, I would assume, more likely to have some grassland birds in it. So maybe leave that until last and then mob graze it. So, yeah, I think it's, I've learned quite a bit, and you've dispelled quite a few of the misconceptions that I had in my head, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners maybe didn't understand that the needs of grassland birds and the needs of grazers and animals alike are pretty tied. And what I really wanted to say is I appreciate how you are bringing in not just, you know, you're coming at it as a Audubon Society employee, but you're a farmer also. You understand that, you know, in these small communities, the farms are the backbones of the community. So you can't just come in and, you know, say we're going to base our entire economy off of birds. You have to work with the farmers, and you've been able to explain in a very good way about how everything is kind of tied together. You know, the farmers are tied to the birds are tied to the land is tied to the community. It's a really nice way to put everything together so that almost anybody listening to this will find something that I've hoped they'll find something that they're interested in or that they care about and can see that it can actually be tied back to farming or grazing or birds or just wildlife management in general. So I appreciate that. That's a very, very surprising episode of me learning a bunch of things on live on air.
Yeah, I sure appreciate you having me here today. I look forward to working with you on some projects here coming up too.
Yeah, I think that'll be a great fit to, you know, work together with the basketball program and do some more education surrounding grassland birds. For those that maybe don't know, the basketball school forest, Paul Brandt School Forest, is a forest owned by Basketball School District that's in Crawford County, and they've got about 30 acres of native prairie, and they've got some woodland there. They make maple syrup. They utilize the school forest for tons of different educational opportunities, and moving forward, they're going to have the Mark Trum Legacy Rotational Grazing Program, and so we're going to graze some cattle out there on an old hay field. So we wanted to ask Ashley a little bit about grassland birds and how we can, you know, tie those things together so that the youth of America, well, more so basketball, can learn about grazing and how it can benefit both grassland birds and the farmer who's grazing it. So we look forward to having your expertise on the project, Ashley.
Absolutely. Look forward to it.
So, yeah, thank you for stopping by. I'm sure we'll catch up here again soon sometime. I appreciate you stopping by, Ashley. This has been the Crawford Stewardship Podcast. I am your host, Joseph Childs. Today I sat down here with Amy Fenn, our executive director here at Crawford Stewardship Project, as well as Ashley Steinke. Ashley is the grassland ecologist for the National Audubon Society in Wisconsin. He's also a grass-fed, grass-finished beef producer in northern Wisconsin. This has been the Crawford Stewardship Podcast. You can listen to this on WDRT.org for this episode, as well as many other archival episodes of great shows. So thanks for stopping in.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me.
All right, bye.